From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When the Drifters had their first big hit, it was Benny King who sang lead vocals. As a solo artist, his hits included Stand By Me. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Benny King, and he tells us the secret identity of Elmo Glick, who's listed as King's co-composer on Stand By Me. We also meet screenwriter Sean Slovo. The story of her childhood in South Africa inspired the movie A World Apart. Pianist Dick Hyman begins a series on the history of the jazz piano. Today he plays the music of Jelly Roll Morton. And critic at large Laurie Stone reviews the Broadway revival of Ain't Misbehavin', a Fats Waller musical. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ben E. King sang lead with the Drifters from 1958 to 1960. As soon as he left the Drifters, he started a solo career. His biggest hit was a song he wrote.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me.
Stand By Me made it to number 4 on the charts in 1961. 25 years later, Stand By Me was used as the theme for the film of the same name. The record was re-released and landed back in the top 10. Other Benny King solo hits include Spanish Harlem, Don't Play That Song, and I Who Have Nothing. With the Drifters, he recorded There Goes My Baby, This Magic Moment, Save the Last Dance for Me, and I Count the Tears. Before Ben E. King ever sang on stage or in the recording studio, he sang with his friends on the streets of Harlem.
I was born in Henderson, North Carolina, so I wasn't familiar with the street singing thing until I came to New York, which I was about 11 years old when my parents first moved to New York. And I heard about it, and then gradually, by being in the streets of Harlem, I walked around and, surely enough, bumped into different little guys singing and doo-wopping on the stoops and stuff like that. So I was more or less introduced to it when I first got to New York.
Did singing in a vocal group on the streets give you the same kind of security as belonging to a gang?
Yeah, well, it gave me I would imagine a means of communicating with other people, because I was a very shy person when I first got to New York. I guess just the fear of New York itself made me that way. It gave me a chance to meet nice people, nice guys to hang out with, kind of. And it was the alternative to other type of gangs. We had gangs during our time as well, but I fortunately for myself, I bumped into, I think, the right kind of people, you know.
Now, you also sang, before you started recording, you sang at Amateur Night at the Apollo
yeah.
Theater in Harlem. Did you all have matching suits in your group?
Yeah, we had, what did we have? We had pink jackets.
Oh, great.
I know, right? That's what I said. Pink jackets and black shirt and black trousers. I mean, it was a sight to behold that, yeah.
Did you save up for the suits?
Yeah, we did. Well, what happened was that our parents gave us some money for it, because we were all, like, in school, you know, so our parents gave us money to go and buy these little uniform jackets and stuff, and we just found our own black trousers and stuff, yeah.
Did you have a choreographer also?
Not as such. What we had done, though, because I lived 116th Street and 8th Avenue, which was only maybe a few blocks from the Apollo itself, which was, Apollo was 125th. So really, I would go to the Apollo a lot. We all did, you know, and see all the other groups and just learn the things that they were doing and practice it in the streets and stuff like that. So we more or less had our own little routine, just taking it from different groups that was already professionals.
Which was the hottest group at the time that you really tried to emulate?
I would imagine like the Flamingos and the Spaniels, the Clovers, the Platters, people like that, you know. And like I say, we had a chance to go up to the Apollo and see him and like learn things from him.
That's great. Singer Benny King is my guest. Now, you sang with the Crowns.
Yeah.
The Five Crowns. And you sang bass before you started singing lead. Can your voice still go that low?
I think so. Yeah, it can't. I'm naturally a bass baritone. I guess that's what my voice tend to go very heavy. I'm naturally a bass baritone, so I can sing bass still, I think, yeah.
Did it have a certain prestige to be the bass man in a vocal group?
Well, girls always thought so. Girls like the bass singer, I guess, because he had that more mature depth to his voice. And they tend to howl around. And at that time, you have to realize that most of the bass things were done in the doo-wop groups and stuff like that was the featured thing in the song, you know. So the bass singer was the one that was doing the doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-doo, all that stuff, see? So you couldn't go wrong with that, you know. So I had the chance to do all those things, and the girls was just standing around and giggle and stuff. So I think that was, you know, one of the key things that helped me as far as getting me introduced to the females there.
Oh, that's great. Well, you went from bass singer with the Crowns to lead singer with the Drifters.
Yeah.
And before I ask you to tell us the story about how the Crowns became the new Drifters and how you got to sing lead, I want to play the first song that you recorded singing lead as the lead singer of the Drifters. And
okay.
This is There Goes My Baby. Benny King singing lead with the Drifters on There Goes My Baby. So tell us how the Crowns, who you sang with, became the Drifters.
Well, that's one of those strange stories, really. I joined the Crowns because the guy that was managing them by the name of Lover Patterson lived across the street from my father's restaurant. So he came in one day and asked me to join the Crowns. He brought them into the store and we rehearsed in the back of my father's restaurant, and I became a member. And the Crowns were, I would imagine, a very good, like, vocal type group, semi-pro. And we opened up at the Apollo with Ray Charles and I think it was Faye Adams on the bill. And, of course, the Drifters were on the bill as well. And we were the opening act. During that week, we were approached by their manager, George Treadwell. And he had mentioned to us that he had been watching us and he thought we were a very good group. And would we be interested in becoming a new set of Drifters?
He had just, fired Clyde McFadder, who had been the lead singer.
Yeah, well, what had happened in that, I think Clyde really wasn't in the group at that time. Clyde had more or less gone solo, but the other members were in the group. And he had, had problems with the group, or the group had problems with him. And they decided to just split company, and they did so, you know.
Right, so Clyde McFadder had left the group, and then the producer fired the rest of the
Drifters.
That's
of the
way it worked.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And when the producer decided that your group would be the next Drifters, did they do anything different with you or tell you to do anything different for you to become Drifters?
Not really. I think that was the strange thing about the whole situation is that when we became a new set of Drifters, there weren't any instructions at all given to us. You know, we used to go on the road as the new set of Drifters before the record was released, and we were booed off the stage, and we had bottles thrown at us and chairs and the whole nine yards. So we weren't given any warning to what to do, how to act. We got uniforms, and I think we got a new station wagon or something like that. But that's the only thing that we received as far as become a new set of Drifters, as well as the fact that we had to fulfill the Drifters' recording contracts, and we weren't aware of that. You know, we were just four or five kids coming out of Harlem from a very, very amateurish background. Even during the time with the Five Crowns, we were just more or less as I said before, semi-pro, so we didn't know about all the particulars that professionals would go through to more or less make a living in the business.
You got booed because the fans were expecting the other drifters, and here you were with no explanation.
That's right, exactly. Well, it's like going to see the four, I always say it's like going to see the Four Tops, and all of a sudden the curtain opens, there's four guys about 17 years old. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would face, yeah.
Now, when you were telling us about the Crowns, you had sung bass with the Crowns, but you ended up singing lead when the Crowns became the Drifters.
Yeah.
How did you get to sing lead?
I wrote the song "There Goes My Baby," while we was on the road, and when I got back to New York, I showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who produced the date. And while we were in the studio, I was trying to show the lyrics to Charlie Thomas, who was the lead and did all the tenors to the songs. And for some strange reason, he couldn't get the feel of the song. And Jerry Wexler, who was involved with the date as well, came into the control room and said, "Look, Charlie's having trouble with this song. You sing it, you know." And I just went to the mic. I had an advantage over him because I had written the song anyway. So I went to the microphone and started singing, and I was stuck with lead since then.
Stuck, huh?
Yeah, stuck, right?
A lot of the Drifters records had strings
on it,
and they really sound great, and I think they were probably the first or among the first R&B records to have strings on it. Did you go for that idea originally?
Oh, no, that had nothing to do with me. Again, like I said, I was just more or less along for the ride. I wasn't familiar with what went on in the studio. That was my very first time in a really professional studio when we went into the Atlantic Records studio as the Drifters. I didn't know that strings and kettle drums and cellos and all those pretty instruments weren't the norm for anyone that was going into the Atlantic studios. I didn't know that we were making history at that time. That was an idea brought up by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who was brave enough to make that move and change the whole musical history of rock and roll.
Well, I want to play another song that you recorded with the Drifters, and this is, of course, you're singing lead on it. This is a song that made it to number one both on the R&B charts and on the pop charts, which was pretty big deal. Really.
Right. No, that was a great deal during that time, because in that time you have to allow for the fact that they weren't actually playing a lot of black records, and not only weren't they playing a lot of them, they weren't even thinking about crossing them over.
Mm-hmm. You want to say anything else about Save the Last Dance for Me before we hear it?
I'd say The Last Dance still is one of my favorite songs. I re-recorded it recently in an album that I just did not too long ago.
Let's hear your first version of it.
Okay.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye, let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's fine like sparkling wine. Go and have your fun. Laugh and sing. But while we're apart, don't give your heart to anyone. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch?
Well, that still sounds very terrific.
Thank you.
When you found out that you were going to be a lead singer, did that give a new push to your career? Had you been thinking that you weren't going to make it as a backup singer?
Not really. I didn't think about making it as a singer anyhow. I was doing what I was doing to enjoy my life. I didn't pursue a career in show business. I didn't know that you could have a career in show business. I thought that everybody was singing to have fun, not to earn a living, not to anticipate stardom. I still find it fascinating that so much money goes around in this business. I didn't actually start off to be a singer aiming at any particular careers or aiming at any particular spot in life. I just enjoyed music, which I still do very much.
I never got to see the Drifters perform, in the early 60s. And I was wondering, we were talking a little bit earlier about choreography. Yeah. Did you have a lot of choreography in your act?
Not a lot. We did, there are steps that I call short steps, and short steps are done like by groups like Platters and Drifters, and then the fast wide steps are done like Gladys Knight and the Pips and Temptations do wide and fast. And there was the Olympics, a group called the Olympics. They do fast movements and fast steps. We do little short, cute things, you know, things that don't require a lot of sweating and falling down. I'd never learned how to do the split stuff like that. You know, I left all that stuff out. I don't know that. I don't know nothing about doing the split. I could never get into that. Yeah.
You never took off your jacket and threw it into the audience?
I did that.
Did
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I did that. Those things was great. That was easy, you know, and throwing your handkerchief away and stuff. I did those brave things, you know.
I used to love that at the rock and roll shows.
Oh, it was
great.
Yeah,
a
lot of fun, that.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you about how you started your solo career, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is singer Benny King, who started to sing professionally in the early 60s as the lead singer with the Drifters, recording hits like There Goes My Baby and Save the Last Dance for Me. And in his solo career, he recorded Stand By Me, Spanish Harlem, I Who Have Nothing, and other records as well. And we'll hear some of them, talk more about his music after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer Benny King is my guest. You know what I'd like to do? I want to ask you about how you started to perform solo. So why don't I play some of the record that launched your solo career?
Okay.
And this is Spanish Harlem. Benny King, would you explain how you left the Drifters and started singing solo?
Well, what happened in that is that once we got involved with all the recordings and we had all the hit records that we had once we started with the Drifters situation, we were on salary as the new set of Drifters, and we were making like maybe $100 a week or somewhere in that neighborhood. And we were all more or less trying to make ends meet, because that $100 would have to keep us alive on the road, and of course tried to send some money home. So we, in other words, to make a long story short, we had managerial problems. And I along with Charlie Thomas, Doc Green, and Ellsbury Harp, we had discussed trying to go to George Treadwell and ask for a raise. And this is a group with a number one record.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got to the office, we had set up a meeting, we got to the office to discuss this problem that we were having as far as salary. He told me, instead of me standing up to speak for the group, to speak for yourself, and I did so, and he fired me. he was great at firing people. And I walked out of the office assuming that the other guys would follow, and they didn't. The only guy that followed me was the same one that came across the street to my father's restaurant and convinced me to join the Five Crowns, who was Lover Patterson. And it was his determination and his, feeling that I had something in my voice that should keep on. He insisted that I stayed in the business, and he was the one still I find very responsible for me still being here now. You know, I hold him very near and dear. He's long passed away for many years now, but to answer your story, he's the reason why I more or less stayed and started a solo career. The record that you just played recently was Spanish Harlem. was originally supposed to have been a Drifter record. And although I was out of the group, Atlantic, which a lot of companies at that time was doing that, they would call the lead singer back in the group to, and pay him scale just to keep the sound in the group. So they were doing that to me as well. That's why the, if you look at my recording world, the things that go on with me as far as a recording artist, you'll find that I left the group in 1960, but yet and still I recorded a record with the group in 1962, and yet and still I had my own solo career started in 1961. It's very crazy, all that. That's because Atlantic would ask me to come back and to do some Drifter recordings and just pay me scale. So I...
But did you think of Spanish Harlem as a solo record or a Drifter
record? No. Now, get back to that problem. That what happened that it should have been a Drifter record. Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, who at that time we had developed a very strong friendship as writers and producers and friends, and they're the ones that went to Atlantic and spoke to Ahmet Erdogan and asked him would he consider a Spanish Harlem being a Benny King record opposed to a Drifter record. And that's how I started a solo career with that record there, really.
Now, you also recorded Stand By Me as a solo record. Now, you wrote that record.
Yeah.
You wrote, and someone named Elmo Glick gets gets co-writing credits. Did he co-write it with you, or was that
Elmo
someone who just...
Glick was a silent partner for years. Elmo Glick is the pen name, I found this out maybe 4 or 5 years ago, of Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller.
Oh, no.
Those were my ghostwriters, and I didn't know it for many, many years. So just go to show you, right? Yeah. But yeah, as I said earlier, you know, we were just kids out of Harlem with no knowledge at all about legalities and what should happen and what shouldn't happen in this business. And I'm only one out of hundreds and thousands of the artists that got those things happen to, you know. So
well, a lot of artists were deprived altogether of writing credits. So
oh, gotcha.
So I guess in some respects, it was...
I was lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones,
yeah.
I'm one of the lucky ones.
I want to play one of your solo records that I think is one of the most dramatic-sounding pop songs I know. And this is I Who Have Nothing. And this is really high drama. I love this record. as everyone will hear, there are great pauses in this record. And when you come on, there's like timpani behind you.
Mm.
Were the pauses written in? Did you decide how long to pause? Did you know the timpani was going to come in with you?
Some of the things I would rehearse with Jerry Lieb and Mike Stoller, but that was just three guys around a piano. So most of the performing things that was done on the records was just the way I felt at that time. I'm not one of those regimented type recording persons where I know exactly what to do at each particular time in a song. I just close my eyes and go for it. Yeah.
Let's hear it. This is Benny King singing I Who Have Nothing.
I who have nothing. I who am no one. Adore you and want your soul. I'm just a no one with nothing to give you but all. I love. He buys you diamonds, bright, sparkling diamonds. But believe me, dear, when I say that he can give you the world, but he'll never love you the way I love you.
It breaks me up every time I hear that. Were you as emotionally involved in that recording as you sound?
Yes. I think what happened in that is that... my manager and I, to make a long story short, my manager and I, at the time, his name is Al Weil. We were traveling over to Europe to get myself established over in the European market. And we got up one night while we were in Rome, and he had found this songwriter, and we went by this office. And this guy, he was Italian, of course, and he was speaking in Italian. He was playing Italian songs, but he played this one particular song, and my manager and I picked it up right then and there and said, this is a hit record. The guy was singing in Italian, had the same kind of deliverance and the same kind of feeling about the song. I didn't know what the words were saying, but I know the feeling was great. When I got home and we showed it to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stolen, they wrote the English lyrics to it. We knew that the song was great. I think that during that time when I was singing songs, I got very, very involved with it. The whole feel of the song. It's amazing when you grow older, your attitude changes, and you tend to not be as involved and not as, you don't throw your whole self into songs. I listened to myself when I was singing years ago, and I prefer my performance much more than I do today. And I did that with a feeling. When I was doing I Who Have Nothing, I tried to, at that time, compliment a song as a songwriter would have meant it to be.
Just a couple of years ago, when the movie Stand By Me was released, your record was re-released as well and ended up back on the charts, a big hit all over again.
Yeah.
How did that affect your career? What were you doing before the film, and was that changed after?
Before the film, I was traveling in Europe a lot. I was still recording. What else before the film? Before the film, I was more or less working. I was doing quite a lot of work. It's triple, if not more so than triple, since the movie, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a period when you were touring with a group of the Drifters.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a remake, a reconstituted version of the Drifters. And
right.
I think there were two different Drifters groups at the same time.
I cannot begin to tell you how many different groups of Drifters there. I know myself there's about a half a dozen.
Still performing?
Sure, they're doing great too. I mean, doing booming business, you know. I'm the only one I would imagine, other than Clyde, that have actually never gotten back into the group or formed his own set of Drifters kind of thing, you know. I occasionally get back with the guys and do a song or so, you know, and do a couple of shows or whatever. I joined Johnny Moore. Johnny Moore has a group of Drifters in Europe, and they're very, very popular. They're one of the hottest groups in all of Europe. I joined them, I think, in 82 to 83, off and on, flying to Europe and back home, to do a Benny King Drifter-type tour. And that's, you know, it was great, but that he's just only one member. Then they have Charlie Thomas Drifters and Bill Pinkney Drifters. And if you were a member, you could have your Drifters.
Okay, well, I love your singing, and I thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Benny King's latest album is called Save the Last Dance for Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, playwright and actor Harvey Fierstein. He's turned his hit Broadway play, Torch Song Trilogy, into a film. It's the story of a gay man and his relationships with his lovers and his mother. The success on Broadway of this semi-autobiographical play was a landmark in gay theater. I hope you can join us. From Benny King's latest album, this is Two Lovers.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
King's performing career is still going strong. This Labor Day weekend, he's singing in Philadelphia's Rock-A-Rama Festival. Are you going to be going back into the recording studio soon?
Hopefully before this year's over, yeah. We're kind of taking a vacation somewhere around about November, and I hope to start very soon gathering up material to get a record out for the beginning of the year, next year, 89.
I've been speaking with singer Ben E. King, and he recorded Stand By Me, Spanish Harlem, I Who Have Nothing, and was also lead singer with the Drifters in the early 60s. And his latest album is called Save the Last Dance for Me. It's on the EMI Manhattan record label. Benny King is performing Labor Day weekend at the Rock-A-Rama in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla. His contemporary music is based on the tango. Tango traditionalists call him the assassin of the tango, but he's helped to spark an international revival of the tango. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Screenwriter Sean Slovo didn't have to invent the plot of the movie A World Apart, she lived it. Slovo's parents were white South Africans working to end apartheid. As a child, Slovo struggled between admiring her parents' convictions and resenting their preoccupation with politics. Coming up, Sean Slovo talks about her life and its movie adaptation. Our new performer in residence, Dick Hyman, demonstrates how Jelly Roll Morton changed the sound of jazz piano. And critic at large Laurie Stone on another piano great, Fats Waller. Laurie reviews the Broadway revival of Ain't Misbehavin', the musical review of Fats Waller songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Michael Dukakis said today he has rehired former aide John Sasso in a move apparently aimed at reviving his stalled presidential campaign. Sasso resigned as campaign manager last September after admitting he circulated a videotape that helped drive party rival Joseph Biden from the Democratic primary race. In San Jose, California today, Dukakis said Sasso made a serious mistake, but he said he's paid the price.
Because we're heading now to the final stretch of what has been an 18-month marathon, and I want the strongest, the best, the most talented team I possibly can.
Dukakis said Sasso will become vice chairman of his campaign, placing him ahead of Susan Estrich, who replaced Sasso as campaign manager. Polish labor leader Lech Wałęsa went on the road today in an effort to end remaining labor strikes. Wałęsa set off from Gdańsk on a 440-mile drive to the July Manifesto coal mine, where workers continue to resist his back-to-work appeal. The striking miners are demanding a personal explanation from the Solidarity leader. Wałęsa called for an end to Poland's worst wave of labor unrest in 7 years after receiving government assurances that it will consider worker demands to legalize the banned trade union. Thousands of strikers in Gdańsk and at other industrial sites have heeded Wałęsa's call, returning to their jobs today. The unemployment rate in August rose to 5.6%, an increase of 0.2 points from the month before. Details from Dale Willman.
While jobs in the service sector continued to increase last month, the growth there was offset by losses in the oil and gas industries, as well as a drop in factory and construction jobs. Janet Norwood, the Statistics Commissioner for the Labor Department, told the Joint Economic Committee of Congress this morning that those losses essentially set off a battle of the sexes.
The lack of real movement in employment reflected a gain among adult women that was largely offset by a small decline among men and teenagers.
Both men and teenagers saw about a 0.5% increase in unemployment for last month, and Hispanics, after 2 months of job gains, also saw an increase in joblessness to 8.4%. For National Public Radio, this is Dale Willman on Capitol Hill.
Stock prices surged today in moderately active trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 52 points, closing the week at 2054.59. Advances led declines 4-1 in trading of 159 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 63 cents. Four Yonkers City councilmen spared from jail today by a Supreme Court ruling said they will remain firm in their rejection of a court-ordered desegregation plan. The four failed to reach a compromise during a meeting today with U.S. District Judge Leonard Sand in the legal fight that threatens to bankrupt the city of Yonkers. Firefighters in the West are bracing for a tough Labor Day weekend as wildfires continue to scorch thousands of acres of brush, grass, and forest land. Alan Saporn of member station KLCC has details.
The 11 western states affected by the wildfires cover a massive expanse of land, and the weather and the terrain varies greatly. Consequently, so do the fires. Brush and grassland fires burn very rapidly, consuming acreage quickly. But the forest fires burn much hotter and can prove more treacherous. Lately, the winds have been calm further west, and Oregon firefighters report some success in controlling blazes here. In Wyoming, however, winds played havoc with firefighting efforts for weeks. Now the winds have subsided, but the air inversion left behind has made aircraft use impossible. Without air support in fighting these huge fires, firefighters are just trying to cut their losses. Officials are asking Labor Day campers to use extreme caution. In Oregon, authorities suggested going to the beach instead of the woods. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Suporin reporting.
A Gulf weather system surprised forecasters by strengthening today into Hurricane Debbie, which is bearing down on the east coast of Mexico. I'm Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and today we introduce our new performer in residence. That's pianist and composer Dick Hyman performing The Pearls by Jelly Roll Morton. During the next several weeks on Fresh Air, Dick Hyman will present a history of early jazz piano. As a performer, composer, and arranger, Hyman has played a significant role in recreating the early classic jazz repertoire and has created the musical atmosphere for some of Woody Allen's films. He wrote original music for The Purple Rose of Cairo and was the music supervisor for Radio Days. Dick Hyman traces his interest in early jazz back to when he was a child.
Among those 78 RPM records that surrounded me as I grew up, a collection that my big brother got together and eventually left me when he went out into the great world, was a bunch of sides by Jelly Roll Morton, Ferdinand Lamont Jelly Roll Morton, who was a New Orleans pianist born in 1885, and he died in 1941. He was as much a composer as he was a piano player. And the interesting thing about his piano playing is that it crosses over from ragtime into what you might call traditional jazz piano. Jelly Roll Morton's piano style seemed to include many of the elements of a New Orleans marching band. You can hear a trombone in it. And you can hear clarinet fills. and you can hear the trumpet playing the melody. And withal, it's got a certain swing, which makes it a bit different from the ragtime. It's, I would think, the crossover point, turning point, when ragtime became what we might call jazz in the early 1920s. And Jelly Roll Morton certainly was one of those who was very responsible for it. Here is a composition of Jelly Roll's which dates from the early 1920s. It's called Shreveport Stomp.
Dick Hyman will return next week with the music of pianist Errol Garner. This is Fresh Air. The new film, A World Apart, is about how apartheid tears apart families. The story is told from the point of view of a white 13-year-old girl whose parents are active in the anti-apartheid movement. The girl doesn't fully understand their commitment, and she's jealous because she must compete with the movement for her parents' time. The screenplay for A World Apart was written by my guest, Sean Slovo, and it's based on her experiences growing up in South Africa in the early 60s. Both her parents were members of the African National Congress. Her father, Joe Slovo, was a lawyer who represented blacks who challenged the race laws. Her mother, Ruth First, was a journalist who reported on the extreme conditions blacks worked under. Ruth First was arrested in 1963 under the provisions of the 90-Day Act, which allowed the authorities to imprison anyone without charges for up to 90 days. Sean Slovo remembers her mother's arrest vividly and made it a central scene of the new movie.
You're not going to take the address book. You can't take that. It's got the telephone numbers of our doctor, our dentist, all the children's friends.
There are names and numbers of banned people in there, Mrs. Rowe.
For God's sake, I'm a journalist. Diana, what's happening? They're arresting me.
Oh, no.
It's 90 days.
Oh, my God.
Mom, please.
Go and pack your suitcase, Mrs. Rowe.
Come on, help me. Jude, don't forget to remind Gran about the orthodontist this week. Molly, you must ask the Abelsons to collect you for writing.
No books except the Bible. No writing paper, no papers.
I asked Sean Slovo what kind of reporting her mother was known for.
She was known for exposing conditions of migrant workers, of mine workers, of farm labor exploitation. This was her particular focus, but she was also a member of the African National Congress, and both my parents were very much involved in strategy and planning of the African National Congress while it was a legal movement up until 1961, and then after that when it became when it was banned and became an illegal movement.
Your mother died because of a parcel bomb in 1982. Did you start writing the screenplay after that? Was this a way to remember her in a way?
Well, I think, you know, what happened was that, like most mother-daughters, we had quite an intense and volatile relationship, and it was complicated by the politics of the time. Towards the end of my mother's life, and because we were both getting older, we were beginning to be able to talk about the past and about the anger, about the guilt. And then suddenly on August 17th, 1982, she was assassinated. And the feelings were still there and she wasn't. So that's why I wrote the script, as a way of coming to terms with her death and a way of resolving certain things in my own mind.
The story is pretty autobiographical. You were, I guess, like the young girl in the movie, you were around 13 when your mother was arrested. There are scenes in the movie where the 13-year-old girl is with her mother with police guards watching, and the girl is crying, saying, please don't take my mother away. Mommy, please don't go. Please don't go. There's a scene in the prison where the mother and daughter meet, and the daughter is crying. And the mother keeps telling her, you can't show your emotion around them. You can't let them, the guards, let them see you this way. Did that actually happen to you, and did your mother have to tell you to button up your emotions while you're around the police?
Well, if she didn't exactly have to articulate it, I mean, I took that from the way that she behaved in front of the security forces, the way she tried to maintain a sense of dignity and not let them see how they were getting to her. And I think, you know, it's the same effect, in effect, that, you know, that's what I took from her. Don't let them see how you feel. Don't give them any kind of satisfaction.
Now, the daughter in the movie has a growing awareness of what apartheid is and how it works and why it's bad, But she's still very young, and she hasn't experienced much of that firsthand. She hasn't experienced the oppression firsthand. She's experienced only the privilege. She feels very jealous in the movie of her mother's commitment to politics, her mother's commitment to fighting against apartheid. Is this what you went through with your own mother, wishing that she had more time for you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think like every child, you know, your parents are the center of your world. And so you can't help but resent the fact that that a lot of their time and energy is focused on the struggle on behalf of 28 million black South Africans. What it does is create some kind of ambiguity, because on the one hand, you want this attention. On the other hand, you can see the evidence of apartheid and you understand the nature of your parents' commitment. And so you feel selfish to demand some of that attention that is being focused on their political work. And that's, you know, a dilemma for the child, for me, for my sisters.
When you were a child?
When I was a child.
Did you talk about that with your mother when you were a child?
Not when I was a child, no. You know, I mean, later on, yes. And, you know, she said something very interesting in the years before her assassination. She said that had she and my father known the way the struggle was going to progress, they would have thought twice about having a family. Because in the 50s, early 50s, when we were born, I was born in 1950 and my two sisters after that, they were very kind of heady, optimistic days. There was a real faith in the process of democratic change, to democratic struggle to achieve, peaceful protest to achieve some kind of progress.
Looking back, do you understand your mother's commitment to the struggle now, and do you still feel at all jealous of the time she took away from you?
Yes, both. The answer is yes to both of those. Both of those feelings. I mean, I absolutely understand her commitment. There was some dialogue in the film, which was in the final confrontation between the mother and the daughter. The mother says, "Would you have preferred it if we'd been different, if we'd been like your best friend's mother, completely apolitical and with nothing to do but go to the hairdresser and stand by all the time?" And the daughter answers, yes, no, yes, no. And I think, you know, I mean, you can absolutely respect that kind of commitment and understand the choices that your parents make, and at the same time resent the fact that what it does is prevent you from growing up at a proper pace.
Your movie ends shortly after the mother gets out of jail, and she's basically banned. She's sentenced to house arrest.
Mm.
What happened to you in real life shortly after that?
Well, you know, as the movie shows, my father had left the country and on some kind of mission to do with his work for the African National Congress. While he was out of the country, there was the Rivonia raid, where they arrested Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Governor Mbeki, and the others. As Joe Slover, my father, was part of that policy formulating group, he became a wanted man, so he couldn't come back into the country. Then, after my mother was finally released after 117 days in solitary confinement, she was then banned, which meant that she couldn't work in the country. And as my father was in exile, we joined him in England.
Easier said than done. How did you get out of the country?
Oh, you know, the South African authorities would much rather have had Ruth first out of the country than in the country in the threat that she posed to them. Those were different times. You know, it was embarrassing for them to hold a white middle-class woman in jail for too long. Now they don't care. But those were different times.
How did you feel about leaving South Africa at the time?
Well, you know, one part of it was excitement, but I think it was a huge disruption, particularly in my life. I mean, my sisters were younger, and I just think to go from the kind of country that South Africa is to the kind of country that Britain is, in all sorts of ways, from the climatic to the social and economic differences, was extremely difficult and took a lot of adjusting. On the other hand, I mean, you know, we were lucky compared to the experiences of many families, mostly black and some white, at that time in South Africa. And today.
Now, this is the first movie that you've written.
Yes.
That got actually produced. How does the film compare with what you had in your mind when you were writing it and what you remembered from real life?
Well, you know, I mean, I had quite a unique experience as a film writer, and I think it's, you know, because of the nature of the collaborators, the director Chris Menges and the producer Sarah Radcliffe, and because also it was an autobiographical story, I was kept very close to the production through all stages, in the planning, through the shooting, through the post-production. And I was referred to and deferred to. So at every single stage, you know, I was able to give my input. And, you know, I think what is on the screen is about as close as I could have envisaged in an ideal world.
Sean Slovo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Slovo wrote the screenplay for the new film A World Apart. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
We've been giving us a lot of campaign news, but the traditional kickoff of the campaign doesn't come till Labor Day.
Right.
Things heating up?
Well, a little. At least the Michael Dukakis campaign dropped something of a bombshell today. He announced that he was bringing John Sasso back into his campaign. And you'll remember that the Democratic candidate fired Sasso, who was at that time his top aide this time last year when it came out that Sasso had distributed the attack video on then-candidate Joseph Biden. And in other news, we check in with our producer Peter Breslow, who's been traveling with the Wyoming Centenary Expedition to Mount Everest, and they finally made it to base camp.
Well, thanks, Renee. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Fats Waller music review Ain't Misbehavin' first opened on Broadway 10 years ago and was both a critical and popular success. Now it's back on Broadway, and critic at large Laurie Stone has a review.
You can hear Fats Waller's exuberance and sensualness in the way he touches the piano keys, the tickles, caresses, nips, and slides. Then there's his voice, an insouciant growl punctuated by chuckles and candid asides.
The joint is jumping, it's really jumping. Every Moses on his toes, I mean the joint is jumping. No time for talking. This place is walking, yes. Hit the jug and cut the rug. I said the joint is jumping. Listen.
Mostly Waller keeps his good time face out front, but he admits sadness in songs like Black and Blue, the lyrics of which run, I'm white inside, but that don't help my case. For most of his 39 years, he carted around a 285-pound body and stuffed it with food and drink until, in 1943, he weakened and died. But not before developing into one of Harlem's most nimble stride piano players, carving his own niche between ragtime and big band swing, and not before leaving a rich legacy of compositions and recordings and becoming one of the first international black stars. When, a few weeks ago, a revival of Ain't Misbehavin' opened on Broadway with the original five-member cast, I jumped at the chance to go. But during the first act, I felt like leaving. Sure, the performers, Nell Carter, Armelia McQueen, Charlaine Woodard, Andre DeShields, and Ken Page, could sing and move, but Lord, it was hard to see their talent through the tangle of mannerisms. It seemed the company felt they had to act like circus clowns to ensure attention. They did some great numbers, Tain't Nobody's Business, Honeysuckle Rose, and The Joint is Jumpin', songs in Waller's hands that convey worldly irony and love of appetite. But instead of sly intelligence, in every number eyes popped, hips gyrated frantically, and arms flailed in all directions, while musical phrasing was sacrificed to campy readings and cutesy hijinks. Surprisingly, Act Two was a whole other piece of work. It was as if the performers had taken cold showers, scrubbed off their cartoonish expressions, and come out ready to be sincere. Thoughtfully, inventively, they delivered a wide array of tunes, portraying an equally broad spectrum of moods. DeShield's peacock persona takes too much pleasure in toying with the women in the cast, but singing and dancing alone in the viper's drag, his sinuous moves are so potent they create a contact high. In Carter's solo, Mean to Me, she stands on stage without mugging and lets her voice play with the notes and display its peculiar trumpet-like charms. In the show's most stirring number, Black and Blue, the cast comes together, sitting on chairs, taking turns singing the lines and building to the crescendo couplet, My heart is torn, why was I born? This spare treatment, which spotlights the fine harmonizing voices, is so deft it makes the earlier charade especially baffling. But as Fats would say in explanation, one never knows, do one.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. The Ain't Misbehavin' cast album is on the RCA label. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet singer Helen Merrill. 30 years ago, she made a record with arranger Gil Evans. Shortly before Evans' death, the two collaborated again on a new album of the same songs and arrangements. Next time, Helen Merrill listens with us to both versions. And television critic David Bianculli previews Baby Boom. Last summer's movie starring Diane Keaton is this fall's TV series. This time, Kate Jackson stars as a fast-rising businesswoman whose perfect yuppie life is disrupted when she inherits a baby. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Becky Thorne. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Special thanks to our engineer, Audrey Voblaitis. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.